Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our podcast series, Hidden Growth Champion. Today, we have a special guest on our podcast, Jan Pilbauer. He's the CEO of BankServe Africa. It's a fascinating organization, and I'm really looking forward to Jan to share with us his experience elsewhere. He's well-traveled, he's worked around the world, his experience here at BankServe Africa. And I guess what I'm particularly keen to hear about are the plans and the platforms that they work in and on to make payments, perhaps some of the things that we less notice, that consumers we're less aware of, become reality, both here in South Africa and on the African continent. So Jan, welcome to our podcast. It's great to have you with us. And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. So my name is Jan, and as you said, I have traveled the world because I'm originally Czechoslovakian, but I spent most of my adult life in Canada. That's where I met my French wife, not French Canadian, but French from France, and our two boys were born in Canada. So we are Canadian now. And a few years back, we decided to pack our lives in Canada and move across the ocean down to South Africa and do something different. And yes, BankServe Africa, I think, is a fascinating organization, and it attracted me. And
so Jan, I'd love to know more about BankServe Africa, but just before we go there, you've had quite an illustrious career. You described yourself when we did the introduction earlier as a payments guy. So tell me a little bit more about what does a payments guy do, and does it change across different regions that you've worked in?
Yeah, so I have not always been a payments guy. My background is actually technology. Mm-hmm. And then I was actually working in a different form of payments because I was responsible in Czech Republic, which was my home country, for issuance of currency. So the banknotes every nation loves because they represent something you can be proud of. That's something which I had to manage and look after. So banknotes, notes. And then I switched to the digital side of payments. And yes, being a payments guy, it's difficult because you get excited about something people actually don't want to think about. So there are not many people in the morning who wake up and say, you know what, my objective of the day is to make 3 payments today. No, we make payments because we need to buy something. We almost don't want to experience the payment. But what I do, I wake up in the morning and I make sure that what you want to do as part of your day life actually happens seamlessly in the background. So I think about things nobody wants to think about.
Yeah, it's a great way of putting it. What attracted you to South Africa?
Yeah, South Africa, from payments perspective, was a place where many things in payments happened for the first time. So many of the world's payments first actually happened in South Africa. And BankServe Africa as a company has been around for almost 5 decades. We will celebrate our 50th birthday next year. But things like real-time clearing, something, you know, which became quite popular in the UK and then many, many other parts of the world afterwards. I think it was mid-2000 when it came and went online in South Africa. So when it comes to payments, I think everybody knows about South Africa. The payment circles are relatively small. So the geeks who think about payments, they know what South Africa used to do. And now I think it's a great opportunity for us to take the podium again and show the world how payments can be truly done. And my background is I like to make a difference in the world. And I truly believe that if you use technology properly and well, you can make the world a better place. And while you can still argue that in Canada, there are some people who are underserved when it comes to financial services, I don't think anybody would disagree when you look at South Africa and the rest of Africa, that making a difference when it comes to financial inclusion and all of these things is probably more topical in this part of the world.
Jan, you've also chosen to come to this country at a at a very interesting time, because the kind of the modernization and the relook at the payment system was taking place at that stage. So tell us a little bit about that, about Banks of Africa, and what was special or different about that period of time when you came in.
Yeah, so Banks of Africa is a company which is in the background, right? Not many people know that we exist until something goes wrong. So what we have to ensure is that nothing actually goes wrong, because when you receive your salary or when you go and withdraw money from an ATM or pay with your card at a point of sale, you expect it to work. And also the debit orders, unfortunately, you know, when the time of the month comes and the debit orders come, they come from your account. That's also us. So I apologize for that. But what we do, we move money in the background so you don't have to worry about it. And it's quite a complex environment, because as simple as it seems, in busy days at the beginning of the month, we process around 300 transactions per second. So every second, when you look at the ATMs, the point of sales, and all of these transactions which are happening in real time, has to happen with a speed of 300 transactions per second. So it's quite exciting organization also from a pure mission critical operational perspective. So it makes it quite a special place in terms of criticality of our operations and the technology we run. South Africa has been on this modernization journey for quite some time. And I think many of you may have heard about this new platform called DebiCheck, and that comes to the debit orders and making sure that citizens or people in South Africa, they always mandate or authorize properly someone who wants to collect money from them. So that was probably the first step on the modernization journey. And then when I joined Banks of Africa, we were in early stages of pushing this new payments experience called Rapid Payments. And yeah, that was around 3 years ago. And we have made quite a lot of progress on the program, despite the difficulties and the odds, which probably at the beginning were a little bit against us.
One thing that if I think a couple of years back in working in the financial services industry, banks very much refer to you as BankServe. You've changed that to BankServe Africa. What was the meaning of that, and what has it transpired to in practice?
So BankServe, I think, unfortunately, is also a company somewhere in the US. So there was a little bit of a conflict, which was the practical reason. But the more driver for a change in the name was also a change in the direction of the company. So currently, we are the largest clearinghouse in Africa. And I always like when people use these statements, because it's very hard to validate for anyone, but you probably have to trust me. And we also wanted to signal that we are not only operating in South Africa. Yes, South Africa is our main market, and that's where we make sure that all the systems are running properly. But we have operations in DRC, and we provide different services, I think, across almost 30 countries in the rest of Africa. So showing that BankServe is not only a South African company, but we are really here to serve the entire continent. And we have an ambition to actually help the entire continent was also behind the change in our name.
One of the things that I'm conscious of is not just how invisible often payment infrastructure is in an economy, but how much of a catalyst it can be for economic growth, for development, for trade. Could you give us a sense of how Banks of Africa has become that catalyst, and what impact have you seen it is making beyond South Africa's borders?
Yes, there is a research, a lot of research actually done about how a seamless or efficient modern payment system helps economy to grow. And the economy can be a regional economy, it can be national economy, or even, you know, micro regions within a country. Nobody has ever proven that if you have a modern payment system, it will actually lead to a very good economic performance. However, it has been proven that usually countries which have very good economic performance also have a seamless payment system. And I have to say, what we as payments professionals, the guys who are actually thinking about payments, what we haven't done really well is making payments an easy, simple experience. It's still damn difficult for someone to send money, right? It takes time. It costs a lot of money. You have to exchange a lot of information between the parties. And that's the case nationally, but even more, especially in Africa with all the foreign exchange controls and things, even when you go to, when you want to send money cross border. And you mentioned some of the free trade agreements and the different development communities which have been formed around Africa. And I truly believe if the free trade agreements are to succeed, we need to improve how we move capital. I came from Europe originally, and the single European payment area, you know, free movement of goods, people, but capital as well, and free movement and easy movement of payments was 10 years in the making. So it's not something which happens overnight, but we want to play our part as a company. We are just about to launch a SADC cross-border solution. It's mainly focused now on lower value payments because we are trying to help with the remittances. I don't know if you've had an experience trying to send money from South Africa to Zimbabwe. I had to do it a few months back and it wasn't a simple experience. So now we are licensed as a SADC payments regional payments and settlement operator, and we are going live with a solution where small value of money should be much easier to move. And in Africa, the other challenge is that you have to be moving between not only traditional bank accounts, because not every country, especially in SADC, has a lot of people who are holding money within a bank. We have to create a ubiquitous system which enables people to move money from a mobile wallet to a bank account, between bank accounts, between the wallets.
No, absolutely. And I guess that kind of brings to light the diversity that exists within the ecosystem that you are helping to build. Because I'm hearing in the way you described it, technology companies being involved. I'm hearing regulators being involved. I'm hearing a variety of financial institutions and others being involved. So as much as there's complexity in the system itself, what I'm also hearing is complexity in the ecosystem itself. You're building something that's not fully fleshed out, for which there are new roles that various organizations can play. So if I had to ask you, you know, if you had to cast your eyes, say, 5 years into the future, who would you consider to be the major players, not in name, but in type, that create this ubiquitous payment system, if it is, or at least the infrastructure around it?
So I think we will be probably surprised. So whatever prediction I make will likely be wrong. What I feel is that people don't want to, and I really believe that, people don't want to think about how they, you know, have to pay. We want to only worry about how much. And when you think about it, that's a significant shift in how financial institutions, payment service providers have to evolve their business model. Because what I am seeing around the globe, and you have examples from China or even India, are becoming ubiquitous. And people are less loyal to brands, right? We are less loyal to who we bank with. What we are loyal to is the customer experience, and basically not seeing the friction or not experiencing the friction which still in many industries exist. So I believe the payments will become ubiquitous, like Wi-Fi or internet these days, because even across the continent you see that connectivity is almost everywhere. I believe the payments you will be able to make from wherever you are trying to conduct the transaction. So if you are on a social media platform, you want to buy something there, you should be able to initiate a payment seamlessly from your bank account or from your mobile wallet or wherever you decide to hold value. I also feel 5 to 10 years from now, we will not be restricted only to the traditional currencies. Right? People today, we have money in rand in our bank accounts in South Africa. In the future, I feel a clearinghouse like us will have to enable you to use your rand from your bank account, maybe some central bank digital currency, maybe some loyalty points. South Africa loves loyalty points. Canada is very similar. We accumulate a lot of value in loyalty points. Why can't you actually make a payment portion from one loyalty points, the other one from your bank account? And in order to support this future, which is uncertain and we don't exactly know how it's going to play out, what company like us is doing is creating the underlying infrastructure or platform, if you want, which people can use in a way that we just cannot imagine right now yet. And I sometimes give an example of building roads, right? When you are building the network of roads, you build the highways, then you build smaller roads, and you try to connect the different parts of a country or a continent. And when you are building the physical infrastructure, when you are laying the asphalt and the concrete and all of that stuff, you want for that to be supportive of any form of cars which will be actually riding over it, right? Regardless if it's a bus traveling with many people, if it's a motorcycle or a single car, if it's a combustion engine or if it's an electric car, you don't want to be rebuilding the roads. You may want to tweak the rules a little bit because there is always a rules how people have to behave on roads, but that's what we are doing. We are building the physical infrastructure where inventors and people will come up with the new form of transportation in terms of cars, and that's what will be the payments experience.
Mm. Which really brings me a little bit closer to home or to the current period. And I recall in the conversation we had just before this podcast, we spoke about the importance of never wasting a good crisis. So with that kind of 5 to 10 year picture in mind, what role do you see modern payment systems play in the recovery, in the current state which countries are facing at the moment? And I'm very conscious it's a myriad of conditions. Some are already recovering, well on the path from the pandemic. Some are still ahead of debt crises and similar shocks to their financial systems. So it's not plain sailing. What role do you see modern payment systems play in that macro picture that we are in today?
Yeah, it's going to be a vital role. And let me tell you why. Some experience from the past, the SARS pandemic, I think it was in 2008 or whenever it was in China, actually created a burning platform for people to start moving away from cash. Rightfully or not, people felt that cash could be the medium to transport the disease. So they basically started really preferring digital payments. And since then, I have recently been in China, and you don't really pay with cash anywhere. The QR codes, the WeChats, the Alipays, everybody uses their phones to make a payment, and it has become ubiquitous. They ran into some other challenges because basically deposits moved away from banks, and the regulators in China had to manage the social media giants to behave properly, but that was the move we saw in China. With COVID, many other parts of the world where real-time or faster payment solutions have been available saw a massive influx of payments in those systems. Unfortunately, and that's probably where we failed a little bit because we are still in the build phase. So we will have a new platform called Rapid Payments available for market testing by the end of this calendar year. And we are planning to go live in the first half of next year. So unfortunately, in Africa, we haven't seen this migration to digital payments. People still, when they received the financial aid and even during COVID with the special COVID grant announced by president, people receive the money and they withdraw them in an ATM and then they transact in cash. And our research shows that actually out of 1,500, which was an interesting number, an average South African makes 1,500 payments a year. When I saw this number, I was really surprised and I challenged the team that cannot be correct. And I realized that the inequality in the society creates two worlds. People who transact digitally and they kind of, you know, buy their groceries once a week, but then you also have a lot of people in South Africa who are buying their day-to-day necessities using very, very small payments, right? Your transportation, when you pay your taxi, when you pay your lunch. And 1,500 payments, it's a lot on average for every single South African. And most of these payments are very low value payments. And almost all of them are actually happening in cash. So from the 1,500 payments every South African makes, 9 out of 10, so 90%, are made in cash. And generally, cash is not really helpful when it comes to financial inclusion because people don't have access to savings. You don't build your credit history. The small, medium enterprises, they also don't get access to credit to continue growing their business. And the small, medium enterprises are actually something which are driving the South African economy. So what we are doing, we are trying to really create an experience for people, for small businesses, that they will be motivated and they will be excited to actually migrate away from cash. And if we get it right, and we really believe we will, because it's a community effort. We included, as you said, banks, governments, and everybody else on the journey. If we get it right, we feel financial inclusion in true sense will continue improving. The inequality hopefully will start closing, and we will basically improve people's lives by driving the economy forward. So I think it's really, really fundamental and extremely important what we are doing and what we will do over the next 12 months in terms of how the recovery of the economy is gonna look like.
You know, Jan, it reminds me when I look at similar initiatives in other industries, we find very similar lessons to this. We're involved at the moment, for example, in an initiative around the energy transition and getting people to be comfortable in using different payment methods to purchase electricity, to trade in some cases to sell, to produce their own and then to sell. Some markets allow for that, as well as to consume and consume differently. And I find something very similar, that on their own, people feel quite powerless to do that. But the minute you get various stakeholders together and start to design experiments in which everyone can actually participate in and see immediate feedback from and learn together, in fact, there's an acceleration that takes place. And I often smile when an experiment that was designed to yield results in 2 or 3 months' time, within 3 weeks suddenly, or even less than that, suddenly the information is available. Suddenly you can make a decision. Suddenly everyone can actually move forward because it's transparent, because they've been part of solving the problem differently. So it's really, really very interesting what you say. And we see that across industries today.
And there is a science behind it, Sar, and that's called network economy, right? Because when you talk about the examples you used, or when you talk about payments, this is really about network. Right. So it doesn't work until you have the critical mass. And then the change is actually exponential. And that's something which is super exciting about our business, but also probably the most difficult part. Because when you are driving something like a transformation of the entire industry, in our case, it's a payments industry, so it involves all the banks and everyone, you need to align people behind a common cause. And that's, you know, something which also drove me and I think many of my colleagues into Banksurf Africa, because what makes an organization a successful organization are the right people. We unified behind a purpose, and we really want to touch lives of South Africans or people in the rest of Africa as well. And we want to do it by enabling financial institutions to bring new payments and financial services experience to the market. But what's difficult is you need to align a lot of competitors to agree on what they are willing to actually collaborate on, to, you know, build the roads as I described, and then they can fiercely compete who is going to build the fastest or cheapest or most efficient car which will ride on these roads. And that's something which is quite difficult and will take, or usually takes, a bit of art and science, how you move these initiatives forward. And that's the network problem, because many of these large projects actually fail if you cannot get alignment and if you don't really tip or reach the tipping point or the critical mass. What we have done, which I think worked quite well over the last 2 years or almost 3 years we have been on the journey, is we also learned from other industries, and the technology advancement actually allowed us to engage the community or engage the industry a little bit differently. So I think sometimes I use an example what the 3D printing actually did for manufacturing, that you can 3D print a prototype or test something before you start mass production. We did something very similar when it came to payments. So rather than having this theoretical debate when on a piece of paper we design this new payments platform and the new payments experience, and then you build it for 5 years and you realize at the end of the journey that it's not exactly what you meant, or it's not exactly what the customers actually want or are willing to use, we took a very different approach. We started prototyping from day one. And that's the power of technologies like APIs, microservices. You can start putting small pieces together. And then we went to the community and we said, guys, can you try it with us? Right? This way that somebody can send money to somebody else just using their cell phone number. This is how we would do it. And people don't have to exchange this bank account information or number and the transit code and all of that stuff. And that created excitement. And that's how the network effect actually starts happening, because a couple of banks became, you know, interested. Then the others had a fear of missing out, so they also joined. And that's how we created this movement. And now something which almost seemed impossible 3 years ago, because it was a dream in a couple people's heads, is now a reality. We raised the fund. We raised over 400 million rand to actually build this. And we are in the middle of build. But that's the network. And that's so exciting about it.
It is really fascinating. I did want to ask about a related aspect of this that I think you spoke about, but I just wanted to check with you. And that is whether network effects also help to simplify the problem to be solved. I often find that when you start to design the experiment, the first take of it looks pretty complex. There's so much complexity that each player brings onto the table. There's so many things that people want to solve concurrently for, but when they start to collaborate together, when you start to create focus about what's most important to solve, what would be the proof point that the experiment has been successful, very often we find that the experiment itself becomes much simpler, and that helps to accelerate the process as well. I don't know if you've seen it in your work.
Yes, I did. So there is definitely the community aspect that people working together, they actually try to make more optimal decision. It's always hard to align the various interests, but I feel that, you know, when you kind of look at the problem as the Venn diagram circles, at some point they start overlapping a little bit, and finding the common ground where you can have everyone to agree, and then you start solving for the bigger problems, and kind of breaking down the large complex issues into solvable chunks is something which has worked really, really well for us. One other thing I've learned, and that's an example from India, because I spent some time in India as well, is sometimes I feel, and I unfortunately I am guilty of that problem as well, we have a tendency to overthink many, many things. Yeah. And I had this discussion with some people from governments and banks in India, and you may have heard that they rolled out this digital identity, the digital stack for India. It's called Aadhaar. And that was a foundation for really a change in financial services as well, because usually financial inclusion has to go with digital inclusion, access to data, digital identity, and that's another area we are engaged in. But I asked them, you know, you have 1.4 billion people, I think was the number when I was there, living in India. How did you manage it? Because not everyone, like in Africa, not everyone has a, you know, birth certificate, has a proof of residence. So we have a tendency to always try to solve for these situations when something is not gonna go as planned. And they looked at me, I said, well, we kind of dealt with it as exceptions. So if somebody didn't have a proof who they are, they kind of told us who they were And if there was a duplicity that somebody else was claiming to be the same person, we kind of solved that. I was like, that's brilliant, actually, because sometimes we spend years trying to actually resolve for potential problems or issues we may run into, which we may never actually experience, but we delay the progress by trying to solve for every possibility. Mm-hmm. And when you have 1.4 billion people, you cannot solve for every possibility. You try, you start, and then you basically, you fix it as you go. And that was for me an eye-opener that sometimes, and of course, we cannot take too much risk and all of that stuff, but sometimes really trying something and learning as you go is the way how you achieve innovation.
Yes, absolutely. And it also makes me conscious of how privileged sometimes we are to be working with and building these systems in environments where the book hasn't been written yet, where all the answers are not within reach, where you have to make that leap of faith, because that forces you to adopt a different mindset. And it gets us to challenge some of our very inheld assumptions. Like, for example, there has to be a contingency for everything. The system will not work or will not be stable unless we have every permutation thought through. And in some cases, you cannot know upfront of all the permutations. But then the question is the system smart enough to learn? Will people be able to identify when it's to your point? Is it an exception? And can that be dealt with in a more adaptive way rather than trying to design everything upfront? It is really, really fascinating.
It is. And I have, you know, one of my leadership lessons was throughout my career, actually, to be genuine and to actually tell people that we don't have all the answers. Right. As you said, we are breaking new ground. We are doing things which have not been done in South Africa, but we can get some inspiration from other parts of the world, but it's not exactly the same. It's not, you know, one size fits all. And I have seen throughout my career leaders who felt we always need to have an answer because we are the most senior person in the room. That doesn't work for me because I know for sure I don't know a lot of things. And showing a little bit of the vulnerability, and that's, you know, that goes for inside of the company, but also when you deal with external stakeholders, having the right balance where you actually tell people, this is what I'm trying to resolve. I don't exactly have all the answers, but we as a community, let's try to figure it out. My experience has been that people have more tendency to help you and follow you if you show a bit of this vulnerability. And I know there is a lot of research on that, but it's important to recognize that we don't know all the answers and we need to sort it together.
Absolutely. And I guess, Jan, you, by doing that, you also invite them into the narrative. You invite them to help complete the story with you, because as you said, you don't have all the answers, neither do they, but they help you to write the book together, which is fantastic. Last question from my side. Any lessons you would want to share with fellow innovators, with people who have decided to use the crisis as an opportunity, or who see the opportunity to do that? Perhaps not everyone around them supportive, seeing the opportunity as well as they do, but they feel the urge to do something and something different beyond the confines of their current industry paradigm, current organizational procedures, et cetera, et cetera. What kind of lessons or advice would you want to give to them or want to share with them?
So first of all, I think one overarching advice would be trust your judgment, trust your feelings, because the truth is nobody knows what's going to happen. Right. 18 months ago, I don't think anyone was planning for a global pandemic of that scale. And look where we are. And the world has changed quite a lot. So please trust your judgment. If you feel that you really truly believe in something, don't give up. Many people will tell you this is impossible. You will never get it done. We experienced it on our journey. People said you will never get the 10 or 20 banks on site, you know, they will never agree to this. And that's something which drives me personally, you know, when the odds are against you, you really do whatever it takes to prove other people wrong. but you really need to stick to your guts and make sure that you continue pushing. Of course, you cannot go blindly forever. If it really doesn't work, it's also important to recognize, and that's where probably your community, your stakeholders can help you to find the point, okay, I tried, but it doesn't work, so I need to adjust the course a little bit. But I think it's important not to give up too quickly. And, you know, for me, bringing a little bit of a new, fresh energy to a company which has been around for almost 50 years, as I said, there is a lot of inertia. A lot of people tell you, no, we tried this before. No, we tried that before. It's not going to work. The external factors are changing. Many things are changing. So things which were tried before and didn't work out may actually work now. And you need to enable people and bring them kind of this motivation that they will try it again and again. And eventually, if you get some of the successes under your belt, you will start seeing the culture changing. But please, and that's probably one last lesson learned, because I am not very good at that, be patient. Patience is necessary if you want to succeed in changing, especially established organizations and how they behave and how they innovate. Innovation cannot be done, based on my experience, by a separate team. It's usually not a good idea to just bring a team of smart people who will think differently. You really need to turn majority of your organization to spark the excitement, to unify them behind a bigger cause, where everybody will want to contribute a little bit more than just the normal work they do. And these things take time, right? It takes months. It takes sometimes years to actually achieve that. And you have to be patient. That's something many people don't have in leadership positions. And yeah, people just get frustrated and they give up. But if you are patient, you can really make big difference.
Jan, this was a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you for making the time and speaking to us and sharing your lessons and your insights with our community. Very much appreciated, and thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.